This is Creepy and Geeky, a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Welcome to Creepy and Geeky. I'm your host, Robert, and on today's episode, it's part one in my Saw series. Joining me to talk about Saw 1 and 2 is Ariel Powers-Schaub. Ariel is a senior contributor to and admin assistant for Ghouls Magazine. She also has a book coming out in 2024 about the torture porn subgenre. Welcome back to the show, Ariel.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I cannot wait to talk about this franchise with you.
I see. I've seen you tweeting a few times. You're kind of all over everybody's podcasts this season.
I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky. I have been invited on a few podcasts in this Saw season, Sawtember. So I feel like I'm just popping up everywhere talking about these movies. It's really cool and fun.
Yeah, that's good. Hopefully you're not too talked out about them.
Oh my God. I don't think I could be.
That's good. And I mean, you're literally writing a book about it. So, you know, not just Saw, but, you know, torture porn in general.
And so. Saw does have its own chapter in the book. So,
yeah. Hopefully, since it's kind of the.
It's kind like of the, important.
The movie that kind of started it all.
Yes. So, it's the backbone.
And I found it interesting. Yeah. Because I found it interesting that. It wasn't the one considered the one that started it off. I think it was Hostel. And then, then it got retroactively added into it all.
Yes.
So it makes sense. Why don't we just go ahead and jump right in?
Let's just get right into it.
Yeah. So, these movies, I'm more familiar with probably these two than any of the others, in the franchise, only just because, and mostly the first one, because I've seen the first one, I'd say maybe four or five times.
Yeah.
And then the second one I've seen at least twice, three times now, because I tried to do a rewatch of them all. Like I watched all of them up to 7. Years ago, after all of the first 7 had come out. So I watched all the 7 and enjoyed them. And then a couple of years ago, I tried to do just a full Saw rewatch. And after the second one, I just petered out because I got distracted by other things.
Sure. Yeah. It is a commitment. It is.
Yeah. It's definitely a commitment. And so this time, most of these movies I'm only seeing for the second time. And like I said, Saw 1's been about 4 or 5 now, and then Saw 2, this is my third go through on these. So yeah. I'm not an aficionado by any means on any of these. So
that's okay. We can talk. It's fun to talk about them at whatever point, you know. Exactly. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. A lot of people that I talk to just sort of anecdotally have seen 1 and 2. And then kind of stopped, or like saw 1 and 2 and then, you know, maybe saw 3, but then quit after that. So there's a lot. I think it's pretty common to like have seen the first couple and then move on.
Right. Yeah. Cause I think, you know, well, of course, cause, you know, I talk about 3 in the next episode, but that kind of ends a particular chapter in the series. So I can see where people kind of just go, okay, I'm done with it. I don't need any more than that. And to be fair, I mean, you have to be kind of hearty of stomach to be able to watch these movies. And so it's interesting to go through these, but I enjoy them because there is a lot of story that they've kind of gone through and added to these. And it's fun kind of watching them go, okay, we need to explain what happened in the previous installments. And so they kind of just keep adding more and more to the mythology, which is great, though, because I think they actually do a really good job at it. They're actually one of the most consistent continuities that there is. Like, I would say
absolutely, you know,
on par with like Scream or Chucky in terms of consistency. So
yes. Yes. I think that's one of the things that makes the franchise really special. And even though it doesn't always have the same writers and directors throughout, it's got a lot of creative consistency. A lot of people will work on multiple movies. And I think that that helps. And having a lot of the same actors in a lot of the movies helps too. So it really does feel like a cohesive story, even though that wasn't what it was meant to be in the beginning. It was meant to just be, one movie
One
and that's
movie and
it.
done. I think that's the ultimate thing that I find that's interesting is that because the first movie did so well, they literally pumped out a new one every year for the next, 6 more years, until they, finished the original story with number seven. And, they just, I think every year they were like, okay, this last one did well. Let's do another one. I think they did greenlight a couple of them together, like three and four, they greenlit together. Because they were given Bousman his whole trilogy, and so it's interesting to want to see these. Now this rewatch, I've only gotten up to number six, so, and because it's been years, I have no clue what happens in seven. I've never seen Jigsaw,
I'm excited for you.
and then I have seen Spiral, but I only saw it once in the theaters, so I'm interested in going back to that one. I know Spiral is one of the ones that most of the hardcore fans don't seem to like as much,
Yeah, that
as
seems to be the case. I don't like it very much. I really wish I did. Like, I want to talk myself into liking it more. So maybe, who knows, after I do these podcasts this season, maybe I will end up liking Spiral. But yeah, it had some issues for me, but I never want to yuck anybody's yums. I'm glad it has its fans. I'm excited for Saw 10, Saw X,
Yes. Saw
and
X,
I'm hoping
Saw
that one is more
1.2
for me.
or
Right.
1.5.
Right.
And as much as people might complain, and I haven't heard anybody complain about it, but I think it's interesting that Saw X does, fit between one and two. And it just makes a lot of sense, when you look at this whole series, when it's all done and said, that it's just, it fits in perfectly.
Yes.
So.
Without saying any spoilers for the future, it does make sense to put a story there.
So, but yeah, so Saw number one, the big daddy of them all, the one that I think most people are familiar with, the one that starts it all and sets the tone, for everything to come afterward, is, it's, so I know that James Wan has a lot of fans, and pretty much everything he does has been moderately successful in the horror world. The Insidious movies, the Conjuring movies, all of that stuff, Malignant. So all of that stuff has done really well. I myself am not a big fan. I think he does okay movies, but I've never been like super into his stuff. But Saw, I will say, is probably the one thing that I've actually kind of really enjoyed of his. And so I think that's a, interesting, at least in my opinion, that
His
out of
first
everything
one.
that he's done is just been this first one. So.
I do think that's interesting. I'm a big fan of his, but I get what you mean. And I think, like, there's a documentary about the making of Saw called Game Changer. It's really good. Came out in 2015. You can get it on like special edition Blu-rays sometimes and things. It also might be on YouTube, but it's interesting to watch because they talk a lot about the making of, but they also are talking with James Wan and Leigh Whannell about, sort of kickstarting their careers as students and how hard they worked as students and how like they kind of lived the student dream of making it big. And Leigh Whannell gets a little emotional in the documentary, and he's like, he kind of says we peaked early. Like, it was such a good experience making Saw. He doesn't know how it could ever be that good again. And it's kind of bittersweet, I think. And who knows? Maybe they'll hit the big time again with something together. But they're both not hurting for careers either. So,
Oh, not at all. No, they're both doing very well right now. And I think that, everything that they have done has had lasting impact. Like I said, the Conjuring movies, the the Insidious movies and the Saw franchise, all of those went on to they all spawned their own franchises. And so it's interesting to see that, you know, what their ideas are good. And I just because I'm not a big fan of James Wan doesn't mean that I don't think he's a good director, because I do think he's good. I just haven't really been into his movies as much. I think they're good. They're not terrible. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
The only one that I actively don't really care about, and again, it's more of a taste thing, I just don't care much about Malignant. That's the only one. I just don't understand why that one is so popular.
Yeah. So that's a divisive one. did you ever see Dead Silence?
I have not, but I own the 4K of it.
I am going to watch awesome that at poster. Some
point. Yes, because that's why I bought it. Was for the poster and the slipcover, because I love that artist, Devin Whitehead.
Yes, that I bought it too. I would love to know what you think of Dead Silence when you watch it, because to me it feels, it doesn't go as off the rails as Malignant, but it feels like maybe the seeds of Malignant were there in terms of James Wan being a little wacky. So I'd love to know what you think of it when you do watch it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely, it's on my never ending list of things to watch.
I know.
Especially things in my collection I actually need to sit down and watch. But I watch so much stuff just for the podcast that I'm always like, oh my God, I'm never going to get to anything unless I put it on a list of things I need to watch.
Right.
So, for the show.
This is relatable.
But give me kind of your history with Saw 1 and 2. Like, how did you come to it? Were you did you see it in the theaters? Did you were you a fan right away?
Yeah. So for the first film, I didn't get to see it in theaters, but I, rented it and watched it at home. And I don't even completely remember the entire experience. Like, who else was there? Was I in my house? Was I at someone else's house? Because I was so sucked into the movie that everything else kind of dropped away, which is very dramatic to say, but listeners, you might know I get dramatic when we talk about Saw. and it really did work for me. I was scared of it. I was afraid of the tense parts, in Adam's apartment and in Diana's bedroom. I was afraid of those parts, and I was really intrigued by the police procedural. I had seen Seven. So I was really into that. And then I don't want to put too much emphasis on the twist at the end, because the rest of the movie is so good, but it really is true. Like, the twist at the end blew my mind. And I feel I was just wow, that's something they can do. I didn't even know they could do that. And it made me just want to rewatch the film immediately. So I was a fan right away, and I did go see the second one in theaters when it came out. Absolutely got me with all the twists in that one again. There's three twists in that one. And I didn't guess it. I never try to guess the twist, I don't want to. So I was completely blown away again. And I was oh my God, what are these movies? Are they going to do this every time? So yeah, I was really hooked by Saw 1 and 2 immediately.
Yeah. I know I didn't see any of these in the theater. And I saw the first one probably not too long after it had come out on DVD, but it was quite a while before I watched any of the others. And then I watched them all kind of back to back. I like that this one. Yeah. I like how you mentioned Seven, because this one does have a very Seven kind of aesthetic to it.
Yes.
That kind of permeates this and kind of all of the rest of them. It's kind of it exists in that same world.
Exactly.
But it's if John Kramer was friends with John Doe from from Seven.
They went to school together.
Yeah, they went to school together.
Right.
So yeah, it kind of exists in that same world. So I like that comparison. But yeah, no, I I really enjoyed this one. Having Cary Elwes as one of the main characters is always a plus. Mm-hmm. You know, bringing in Danny Glover as the cop was like, yeah. Okay, cool. You know, this is cool. You know, it was neat. And then two, this was, I think this came out in 2004, right? So this mm-hmm. was just before, this is right around the time Lost came out. Yeah. And so it would be a couple of years, but there were a couple of actors in this, that would then eventually go on to Lost. Mm-hmm. Michael Emerson, who played Zep, and then, the other detective, I can't remember.
Detective Singh, but I can't Detective think of the actor's Singh. Name.
Yeah.
But he was also in Lost.
He was also on Lost. He was in one of the later seasons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was interesting to go back and rewatch this and go, oh yeah, okay. Because I was a huge Lost fan for when it was originally out. So
I was late to the Lost party. I watched it for the first time a few years ago, and I was there's Zep.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's how a lot of people came to it too. They were like, you know, whenever he came on to Lost, like there were a lot of people who were already Saw fans, and
yeah,
then he comes on to Lost a couple of years later and people are like, oh my god, it's up, and I'm like, I don't know who that is. But yeah, no, this is a fun movie. Like, I think it's interesting because it begins kind of all the hallmarks of what we know about the franchise, mm-hmm. but the traps themselves are very minimal.
Yes.
It's very, you know, and they were working on a very small budget, so it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to see that how much they do with this, with so little. And that's what I enjoy a lot about this.
Yeah, the budget was so tight. They had to get really creative with sets, obviously, but they also had to get really creative with time. And they didn't have all their actors for a lot. They didn't have a long filming schedule anyway. I think it was something like 18 days. And then they didn't even have all of the actors for that time. So due to time and budget constraints, they didn't get as much footage as you want to when you're making a feature film. Like, you want to have multiple takes so that you can edit together like the best versions of each one. And there were a lot of times where they could only do one or two takes. And the editor, Kevin Grutert, when he was trying to edit the film together, he was like, I literally don't have enough footage. How can I make a feature length film out of what we have? And so he is basically a hero. He had to get really creative, and he inserted like a lot of stills. He did some shots in like black and white with no sound to make them look like security footage, even though it was just shots of other things in the movie. And that frenetic editing style that became so iconic of the franchise was a result of Kevin Grutert needing to just make some action. So it's so interesting how this movie was pieced together and then became this huge touchstone in the genre.
Right. Well, and I think that's interesting too, because it, like, you know, because he had to make do with all this, that it kind of set that formula, like you said, with mm-hmm. not just the aesthetic part of it, but also how we have all these constant different viewpoints. You're looking at things from, you know, especially in later installments, that then you're looking at things from a different perspective. And so they changed the way they do it, because they've got the mm-hmm. money to afford to redo it all. But, you know, so they take that, what he had to do in editing, and then redo it in reality later on down the road, and make this more convoluted, the way everything just kind of falls into, you know, when you look at it, then later on, you're kind of like, how much time did all this actually take? Like, was this like, 'cause it seems like, you know, you're talking years, but when you look at it all folded together, it's what, maybe a couple weeks, maybe a couple months that Jigsaw's Reign of Terror was going on.
Ah, yes. So, there are, throughout the franchise, there are a few markers that tell you how much time has passed. So in case any listeners haven't watched between 1 and 2, I won't spoil any of that. But there is a definitive answer. to how long Jigsaw's Reign of Terror lasted.
All right. Well, why don't you tell me?
Well, in case it's spoilerific for anybody else.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Yeah. I promise the timeline exists. And listeners, if you want to look it up, there's a really good Saw fandom wiki that lays out the timeline just perfectly. I actually referenced it quite a bit when I was writing my book because I was like, wait, did this happen here or there? Was this before or after this? Because it gets a little hard to, to follow, but like if but I
some
tried
of it's
to...
happening at the same time as something
exactly.
else.
If I tried to write down chronologically what happens in the whole story, I would have to double check my notes.
Yeah. And that's what's that is for me. I like that because I like the twisty nature. I like the time like messing with that kind of stuff and going, oh, okay. So all this was going on. And it makes a lot of sense when we get to the later installments and there's more people involved.
Yes.
Because in this one, we just think there's only one person, well, two people involved. Well, we think it's only one, then we find out it's two, and then we find out just you know who the mastermind behind it all is.
So. And Zepp is really a victim himself, you know.
He is. Yeah.
He's a little bit red herring Jigsaw throughout the film.
Right.
And that works on the first viewing. But it's really John Kramer in the first one.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out later on there might be some more people involved. But just a few. But, you know, it's that this is a spoilerific podcast. We spoil things on here. So it's, you know, but we find out later. I'm not going to mention it right now because we'll get into it in the next, the next movie that we talk about as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I do like this one. You know, it's very tight. It's very contained.
Yes.
There's no real outside, locations. They did everything inside because they had to do it all on like in a location in a soundstage type location, again because of lack of money. And I think that's interesting too, because I'm not positive, you'd be able to tell me this, but I don't think they ever really explain what city they're in.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes.
I like
we
to
never
just
know
call
it's just
it...
some industrial city.
Exactly. Which is also really similar to Seven. They never say in Seven which city they're in. But for the Saw world, I like to call it Saw City. I think that's kind of fun. But no, they never do say.
Yeah. No. I'm not surprised. I mean, it makes sense. It keeps it ambiguous. It could be any city of any size that's got you know, lots of abandoned industrial buildings. So,
and then you don't have to worry about being loyal to geography. You know,
exactly.
If you say it's, you know, some city, then you'll have people from that city going, well, that's not over there. This is over here. How does that work? So we don't have to be distracted by that.
Exactly.
It's like Gotham.
Yeah. Gotham is supposed to be like, you know, a mix of like
fake New York, right?
New York and Chicago. Well, it's supposed to be like a mix between New York and Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Metropolis is supposed to be like similar to New York as well. So I think that's, you know, and I think Gotham is supposed to be closer to Chicago in that way.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong. I'm not a huge DC person. Yeah.
I don't know. You are the definitive voice on comic books on this podcast. So, but yeah, it's similar to that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's just Saw City. You know, it's John Kramer City. That's all we know.
Exactly.
he's the one ruling it.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I enjoy this one. We've got Cary Elwes. We've got Tobin Bell, of course. Mm-hmm. Danny Glover, as I mentioned. Michael Emerson is up. We've got and Lee Whannell playing the other character, and his name is escaping me at the moment.
Adam.
There you go. And I think, you know, Lee Whannell is a good actor. I've seen him pop up in a couple of other things. Like he was in Cooties. I think he wrote that one as well.
I've not seen that, but it is on my list.
That one's funny. Yeah. It's good. Yeah. So it's an interesting cast, and I like how, you know, you've got these two, and it sets that kind of formula up where you got these two people who don't know each other. You don't know what's going on. And you've got these moments where they have to kind of work against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because, you know, it's kind of sets the tone for, again, this movie really sets the tone for everything to come afterward. And I like the consistency of tone they have for everything, mm-hmm. no matter how convoluted it gets, that they keep that tone and the consistency down through every installment.
They really do.
That I've seen so far anyway.
Yeah. I think that they really do, especially in the original like run of movies where you can count on several things when you come to a Saw movie. So, right. And I think the second movie solidifies that a lot more, but the first one definitely sets the stage.
Right. Yeah, I think that's what's great about this 1-2 punch right here is that you get the beginnings, the kind of the idea of it all. And then number two solidifies it and mm-hmm. makes it and kind of makes it really concrete exactly what they're doing and how they're moving forward from there.
Yes.
So is there anything that you don't like about this movie?
That's such a good question. I mean, no, and that is not, that's an emotional response, you know?
Right.
That's not necessarily a critical response. If I wanted to approach this as a critic, there are things that you can comment on. I think Carrie Elwes and Lee Whannell act like they're in a different movie sometimes. And right. I think Danny Glover's too old for this shit sometimes. But like... all the sum of its parts come together to make something that is so special to me that there's nothing that I point to and say, oh, I wish this was different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think for me, the balance between police procedural and people in the trials and traps works really well. Like there's enough room to breathe between the violence. Yeah. I certainly prefer the time we spend with Adam and Dr. Gordon than I do the time we spend with the police, just because I think Adam and Dr. Gordon are more interesting characters, but right. I don't dislike the time we spend with the cops.
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree with that. I think that, you know, Danny Glover definitely is kind of, I don't know, he's just kind of grumbling his way through it. And yes. Not necessarily in a bad way, but it definitely doesn't seem like he's super engaged in the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's also because it's a small part. And like we said, mm-hmm. like you said, it was a small part, but it's also not that many days. And,
yes.
you know, and they were all kind of working. And this may be why it feels like Carrie Elwes and Lee Whannell were in two different movies. They probably weren't on set together all the time either.
That's right. So, that's true.
So, the, you know, they had to act against, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. sure Lee Whannell was there all the time, but maybe yes. Carrie Elwes wasn't there all the time.
Yeah, so, they had Carrie Elwes for about 6 days. So yeah. Some of Adam's lines where it's like Dr. Gordon will say something and then Adam will respond. And you're like, whoa, that was really tonally jarring. Like, yeah. It's because they were literally happening separately.
Yeah. Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, mm-hmm. it, you know, if you've got only that much time, then you've got to make do of it. Which yeah. can. I do. There's a part in it that kind of makes me laugh. He gets on the phone and he thinks it's Zep and he's like yes. Yelling at him. And he's like, oh, my God. And then it's his wife. He's like, Allie, the way he yes. says it just cracks me up so bad because it's just so. Like, weird. It just,
yes.
It's just a. I don't know. It just doesn't there, sound like the way you would make it sound normally.
No, so. There are so many line deliveries in this movie that are outside of reality. Like that scene you just referenced where he goes, I'm gonna kill you, you bastard. And then he goes, yeah. Allie? It's like two different actors. And then later Zep has one where he's, you know, Allie and Diana have escaped and Zep is chasing them down. He's calling out and he's loading his gun and he says, I'm going to kill your husband now, Mrs. Gordon. But when he says Gordon, his voice drops several registers and he does like a growl. And I don't know what that choice was about. It doesn't seem like a way humans speak, but I just like the whole thing is so heightened and unreal that I just sort of accept that as
you just kind of go with it. No, I think that's what's funny is there's like those little moments here and there that you just kind of take you out for a second, but then you just get pulled right back into it. So I'm never like that. Like I said, that part where it's like, Allie cracks me up, but like I get back into it. It's just like for a second, I'm like, whoa, what? Like, all right. And Cary always, he's so good at comedy that like, it's almost a comedic line and almost like he's doing it on purpose. And I don't think he is, but it just takes you out for just that second. And I'm just like, okay, got to get back.
It's kind of surreal. So,
I think beyond that, like you said, the little things that kind of here and there you might niggle about, but for the most part, the movie is so good and so sound that you really can't complain about much of it. So I enjoy the most. I enjoy most of it for sure. Do you have any particular favorite scenes or kills or anything?
Yes. So probably very basic to say, but I love Amanda's everything involving Amanda. The reverse bear trap sequence is iconic, and it's the only trap we see from pretty much beginning to end. And that makes sense because she survives it. So like we spend the most time with her. This trap, like this sequence with Amanda, tells us several things about Jigsaw in a movie where we don't really get to know him that well. You know, it tells us about why and how he picks his victims. It tells us that he's willing to lie. You know, he tells Amanda, there's a key in the stomach of your dead cellmate. He's not dead. She has to kill him. And that's not a mistake. Like, if Jigsaw wanted that person to be dead, he would be. He was, you know, the test of Amanda was, how badly do you want to stay alive? Are you willing to kill someone? So it's a really efficient scene in that it shows us his engineering capability. And just sort of like his mindset going into everything. Plus, I just love Amanda as a character, and the reverse bear trap is my favorite trap. And I have to give a shout out to Shawnee Smith, because she had 102 degree fever and the flu when she did her scenes, and she did an excellent job.
Oh, yeah. No, I would think that's the highlight of the whole movie is Amanda with the reverse bear trap. I mean, it's very iconic. I mean, they even put it in their recent Blu-ray set. I know you got it.
Yes.
but yeah, it's I agree. I think that's just this just such an iconic scene and part of what little it tells you about Jigsaw / John Kramer before the later movies. And it tells you a little bit about Amanda as well. Not a whole lot, but you know, but a little bit, and you know, leads into the next movie.
There's another
go ahead.
There's another part in the first movie that I really like. Well, there's two. Okay. I promise I'll limit it to two. the sequence in Adam's apartment, I think, is really well done. Yeah. Where, you know, it's a really grungy apartment. The setting is not nice. He calls it his shithole apartment. And you're like, I see that. He's developing photos. So it's dark and there's red light. And then you have the sequence with the camera flashing, which is done really well to add some scary sounds and sights to this really simple scene. And then you've got Billy the puppet scaring the crap out of everybody. So like, I think that is the scariest scene in the movie. And it works really well. The other scene I like a lot is with Dr. Gordon's family at home. And I think that's another really efficient bit of storytelling where his daughter, Diana, comes out and says, I think it's really important to note, she says, there's a man in my room. Right. And, you know, it's not like she said, there's a monster under my bed or in my closet. She said, there's a man in my room. But her parents are so wrapped up in their own argument that they don't really listen to that. Like, Dr. Gordon goes to tuck her in and like soothe her and get her back to bed. But I'm not a parent, so I don't know. But I feel like the words, "there's a man in my room," might trigger me to open the closet and look.
Right.
But he does not do that because he's really focused on going to do other things. So I think that's a really efficient bit of storytelling.
Yeah. No, and that's definitely one of the scarier bits too, because if you catch that, you know, that's just like, ooh, that's creepy. Because she did say, like, you know, kids don't usually go, "oh, there's a man in my room." They'll say there's a monster, you know? So, yeah,
right.
It's a little
or
bit,
there's something, you know, like they'll be more vague about what it could be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's definitely a scary scene. And then, you know, he just, the mom comes in after she screams, and then she sees the guy take her, you know, and
that's
so
terrifying.
It's just, yeah. So yeah, that's definitely a great scene. I agree about the Adam one as well. His apartment, that whole sequence is nice because of the camera flashing. So they do a lot of good work in this with the limited budget that they have. So, and that's what's
they do
nice about it, that, you know, and even the later installments, yes, they get higher budgets, but it doesn't super feel like it. They get to do more elaborate traps out of it, but they're keeping to the overall aesthetic and low, like not low production values, but just, you know, the not needing for like a lot of fancy stuff.
Right.
Other
like
than,
keeping
other
it
than
really
the traps.
Straightforward.
Right.
Of like, here are the things we need to make this story. And then they put the budget in places where it matters more.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Trying to think, is there anything else you want to say specifically about this movie before we move on to number two?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, there's a ton we can say about it.
I know. There's so much we could say. I don't think so. I think we highlighted the really important factors and its important place in history. I think from two on, it starts to be more about the plot of what happens in the movie itself, whereas the first one is almost like a prologue setup.
Yeah, that it does feel like that. It feels like number one's a prologue to everything else that comes along. Because after this point, everything starts to get convoluted and, you know, and twisty in ways that that you're not fully prepared for, and that they weren't fully prepared for, since this series wasn't envisioned as an actual series. So I do think it's interesting that they held that consistency as long as they did. That's really cool. But number two, you know, introduces us to a few things. One, it's Darren Lynn Bousman as the director for the next three movies, 2, 3, and 4. And eventually he comes back to do Spiral as well. It also introduces us to some recurring characters. We get Detective Eric Matthews and Detective Carrie.
Yep.
And Amanda's back.
Amanda's back.
Yeah. So, and this one introduces a concept that I actually like more than others. This one, and I think number five, have the concept of a group in a setting, and they have to try to work together, but inevitably work against each other and fail.
It's like a nightmare team building exercise, like a corporate retreat.
With people you have no clue who they are.
Yes.
And you're all fighting to survive.
And you're dying. You're actively dying. Yeah.
And instead of helping each other, you're just trying to throw each other, you know, under the bus and not be the one to die. You know, it's that whole adage of, I don't have to be faster than the bear. I just have to be faster than you. And that's how they're all acting. It's like, I just have to be faster than all of you so that I can be the last person out of here. You know?
Yes.
You all can die before me. But inevitably you all die anyway.
Right. So. Right. Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, this is the movie where we really meet Jigsaw, you know, like,
yeah,
we spend a lot of time with him, hearing from him, hearing what he's about, why he does what he does. And so we get a ton of insight into someone we really just got a glimpse at in the first movie. And it's revealed, you know, at the very end that he and Amanda were working together. And so it sort of opens up this whole other world of, we just learned about this person and it's not only him. So like, this expands the world exponentially.
Right. Yeah. And it's an idea that continues to grow movie after movie. Like every movie after this, we get like, every movie has a twist. Every one of these Saw movies has a twist to them at the end. And you're just like, oh my God, what, you know, and there's like somebody else is involved or something else was going on.
Yes.
And there's plot lines that are running concurrently to an earlier movie. And so that's what's great about this one. And this one also kind of introduces that in a way, because, you know, Eric Matthews and people, they find Jigsaw, they confront him, and he's got a bunch of people in the house and they're all on these monitors and, you know, they're all dying one by one on these monitors and they think it's all in real time. But you come to find out at the end, this was a long time ago. This was hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything they're watching was already recorded and, you know, and has already happened. And so I love that aspect of it because, you know, while he's messing with them, and again, it also introduces this concept of don't do, like, this is something he tells the cops all the time. Don't do what you think you have to do. Mm-hmm. Do what I say and everything will be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And every time the cops fail. So it cracks me up every time because I'm just like, you know, if you just sat down and did what he said, you know, you would have gotten through this and everything would be okay.
Your son is in a safe place. Wink, wink, you know,
right?
This is a movie that teaches us to listen really hard to what Jigsaw is saying.
Right.
And we know he has the capacity to lie. We learned that in the first one. But if he does lie, it's to a particular end. Like, he's really focused on whatever his goal is. And in the second movie, his goal is to torture Eric Matthews. So the deceit that he uses of the people in the house being, you know, a taped recording, that's a lie he's essentially telling Eric Matthews. But it's all in service of this idea of, if you sit here and talk with me and don't try to kill me and beat the crap out of me like is in your nature, everything will be okay. Yeah.
But he knows, and this is where it comes down to, and it's mentioned later, he understands people on a level that they don't even understand themselves. So he knows that whenever he tells this person something like this, that they're going to fail. He already knows they're going to fail, but he's trying to get them not to. He's trying to see if they'll actually take the real, you know, the upper, whatever I'm trying to say,
the high road,
the better choice. Yeah. The high road, the better choice. And so whether they'll take that or not. And if they do, then things will work out better. Sure. Some other people are going to die, but, you know, but you'll be okay. And, you know, people around you will be okay. You know, and so, you know, he tries to do that. And every time they fail, because I don't blame them in a way. Why would you believe somebody like that? Why would you play into that? You know, so, but he's always doing it to people who are like not great. They all have their flaws and they all have done things that deserve some kind of justice.
I think I think he's good at picking victims. And what I mean is, like, I can't remember what movie it is, but at some point Jigsaw says like he really understands human nature and like he knows what humans are going to do, and like that might be true, but I also think, like, you know, not to get too serious, but like people who, like, abusers will seek out people who they think will be accepting of their abuse, right? And then you get trapped in this cycle of control and it's hard to leave. I think Jigsaw is operating on a similar wavelength where he knows who he can make a victim and what that person will do. And so, like, I always like to imagine, like, what if he got the wrong person and he totally mispredicted their behavior and they just went against everything he thought they would do? Like, where's the blooper reel for Jigsaw picking victims, you know?
And I think that would actually be a fun twist on it. Like, if they did a movie like that, where somebody actually did the right thing and did the things that, like, against exactly what he said, like, would it actually, I mean, in kind of in a way, well, no, I mean, I was going to say kind of in a way, Amanda did that, but no, she, I mean, she still, you know, killed somebody to save herself. So, but it's, I think that it would be interesting, but again, I think that's about, you know, doing the thing that you need to do to survive. Or would you be willing to do those things? Would you be willing to let somebody else die? Cause that's always what he's doing, is letting other people die.
Yeah.
So that you can stay alive, you know, or so that you can pass his test. He's going to let all these other people die, but you've got to stand back and let it happen. And you know, that was the whole thing with the you know, Detective Riggs later on, you know, in a, I'll talk about that in another episode, but you know, it's just, you know, very similar to that. And you know, it's with these, with these characters in this one specifically, you know, they're all in this house. If they had all sat down, stopped, you know, fighting each other, if they had all discovered the numbers on their back of their necks early, they could have figured it out and gotten out early. You know, they wouldn't have been having to go through the house and all getting killed off one by one. But because they all, like, you know, were freaking out, and I get it. Don't get me wrong. You're going to freak out. But to have all the antagonism that they did and everything else just made it worse.
Yeah. So. And I think that's by design. You know, I think Jigsaw picked people who were going to be at each other's throats.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, he knew, and again, that's where he's, like you said, yes, he's choosing people. He specifically knows how these people are going to act, but he's choosing these people because he knows how they're going to act. You know, it's not like just choosing somebody random off the street. He knows how these people are going to react because he studied them. He knows what they're like, you know, so he knows the kind of choices they're going to make already. So, yes. I mean, it makes sense in that way that it's not really going to happen the way, like, it's always going to happen the way he wants it to, for the most part. So,
and I think that's where it comes back to his goal. Like, so in the second movie, his goal is to torture Eric Matthews. So if things go a little bit wrong in the house, it's not the biggest deal. He still gets the tape and, you know, seeing Daniel Matthews on the screen. But, you know, if things kind of go haywire in the house, Jigsaw can work with that. Like, the thing he really needs is Eric Matthews to come sit down and, you know, eventually say, take me to the house, and then get locked in the bathroom.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny, too, because he knows that he can just, if he just sat there, and if Eric Matthews would just sit there and take the shit that Jigsaw is saying to him, then, you know, and just not engage with it, then everything would be fine. But he knows that that's not going to happen. He knows that Eric Matthews is a particular kind of person because he's chosen these people in this house specifically because of that. These people who've been railroaded by Matthews.
Yes.
And, you know, it's so he knows that this is what he's going to do, and that he just has to push him just a little bit to get him to react the way he wants to react, and to make it, you know, so that he captures him, you know? So it's like, there's so much of this that goes into it. And again, this plays into these later installments as well. This movie really kind of solidifies the whole Jigsaw ethos, you know, his whole plan and everything that goes on with that.
And it gives us the formula for the future movies too, of like, we're going to see several traps in a row, you know, of characters that you care about to varying amounts. And we're going to get some Jigsaw lore weaved in, and then we're going to get a twist. And, you know, it sounds straightforward, but I think they do something great with it in each move. Well, you know, some better than others.
Yeah.
I love all of them, but you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, and in this one, like I said, this one's kind of one of my favorites so far, just because I like the aspect of having a bunch of people in the same location and them all having to try to work together to get out, and then ultimately failing. And they do this again in number five, where you get a group of people together and they are dumb and at each other's throats and, you know, fail to, you know, get to the end as well. So
I think the thing we lose in that is like spending time with the characters to get to know them, you know?
Yeah.
So like in the first movie, and I won't spoil anything, but in the third movie, those are more intimate stories, you know, where you're spending them with fewer characters. So it kind of depends on what you're looking for. You know, if you're in the mood for a Saw movie where you want to see people cycle through the traps, Saw 2 is great for that.
Right.
And sometimes that's what I want.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why they do that too, is, you know, each installment is, you know, a different flavor, you know, and that keeps it interesting for the filmmakers. And it also keeps it interesting for the audience, especially if you are going to be binge watching these, you know, that way each one isn't just like, oh, this is the same stuff over again, you know, maybe a little twist on things, but it's the same thing over again. So far, the only one that I haven't really enjoyed is probably number four.
I love number four, but that one is divisive.
I still like number four. I don't think any of these so far have been bad at all. That's the one that I've just liked least. And that, I think that's the one with Riggs. And it just, that one just, you know, I don't know. I'm just not involved. Like, I'm not pulled in by Riggs himself and his whole journey through it all. And I think some of the traps are a little less spectacular than in the other movies. But that's, I mean, again, that's just more of like a nitpick, you know?
And I think it shows that throughout the franchise, there's, I don't want to say something for everybody, because that's not true, but there's something for a lot of us, you know?
Yeah. If you like these movies, then there's going to be some that you're going to like more than others, you know? Yep. And it always just kind of depends on your own personal preferences and your own, like I said, I like 2 and 5 because of the groove aspect, and, you know, and that's kind of like, and again, I kind of feel like that's the reason why I like the escape room movies.
I love those movies.
Yeah. I love those. And I feel like escape room is kind of like a variation on the Saw formula. They took what 2 and 5 did and then just kind of like extrapolated them into the escape room formula.
Yeah. And, it's Saw for preteens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's pretty gruesome too at times. So
I think it's
more PG-13, but it's still fun, you know?
Yes. Well, I was watching the Saw movies as a teenager. So maybe it's like you and Belle were talking about in the Fear Street episode. Sometimes things that are marketed towards teenagers are actually, teenagers are already beyond it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I love the escape room movies too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. I think, honestly, I would say I probably like the escape room movies more than the Saw movies, but only because of the, because they're lighter. You know what I mean?
They definitely are.
These are more, and I like the Saw movies because of this, but they're more intricate, and you have once you start watching them, you have to watch them all, because you don't get the whole story unless you do. And so I think that so far, at least with the escape room movies, I can just put on both of those and I can get enough of the main story to understand it all. And there's not a lot that I have to go into.
Definitely true. And it's a less bleak, like, it's a gruesome, hard story, but it's not as bleak of a world. Saw City is just bleak.
Saw City is definitely not, like, if I had known all that stuff was going on, I might want to just move.
Yeah, maybe move.
You know,
yeah.
Because you never know, because he just seems to pull anybody, you know.
I know, that, we're all in danger.
And that's what's crazy, is that the people in this one, all the ones who are dying in the house, they didn't really, I mean, yes, they're not necessarily the greatest people. They all went to jail and everything like that, you know, but at the same time, they went to jail because Matthews kind of railroaded them. And so they're all there because of the sins of Matthews. And so it's actually frustrating, because it'd be like, okay, well, I'm here for somebody else's problem. Why aren't you killing him?
Yeah. And this is like, it's no secret that I'm not a Jigsaw defender. Like,
Oh,
I
yeah.
love Jigsaw as a villain, but I think he's full of shit. And
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
yeah, he'll be like, my morality, my teachings, my lessons. And it's like, dude,
Yeah.
you just take whatever selfish path you're on and try to shape it into your morality.
Yeah.
Like, he wanted to torture Eric Matthews. He figured out a way to do it. And then he goes, I'm not killing people technically. And it's like,
Yeah.
okay, if, you know, we read a news story about this happening, we would say the person who put everybody in the death house was a murderer. So come on,
Yeah.
Jigsaw.
Yeah. You know, if the choice is cutting off my arm or dying, you're still giving them like a bad choice. You know, you're
Yeah.
still, you know, and you're putting them in a trap that if they don't make a choice fast enough, then yes, you did kill them.
Yeah.
Yes. You know,
I'm going to go
they,
ahead and say you're responsible for their death.
right? Yeah. You know, and I think any court, any jury in the world would agree. Like
Yeah.
you may have your semantics and everything like that, but in the real world, that doesn't work.
Right.
And his motivations, well, don't get me wrong. I agree. Some of them are justified in terms of being angry. Don't get me wrong. You can be angry. You can't go around killing people because you're angry.
Right.
So
Come on,
I'm
Jigsaw.
definitely not a Jigsaw defender, but I still enjoy the movies. So
Oh,
I mean, but
absolutely.
that's like any slasher. I mean, come on, you can't tell me that
Yes.
most of us don't root for the villain in these movies.
Right.
You know, you want to see Jason hack everybody up. You want to see Michael J hack everybody up. So
Yes.
that's what you're here for the at the Saw franchise for, is to watch people in these death traps. So you don't care about anything else. It's okay. We all agree that's what makes it fun.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of writing, like a lot of analysis about the Saw franchise that tends to focus on John Kramer's sense of justice and morality. And sometimes
Right.
it makes me want to scream because I'm like, you don't really buy this, do you? But
Right.
if we're talking about it in the universe of the movie versus are we talking about it as real people? Right. I don't want to see people get hacked up with a machete unless it is Friday the 13th movie, then I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I can't deal with real violence. Like real
Me
world
either.
violence, no, I absolutely hate it. Don't want to see it. Like when the
Yep.
Faces of Death movies were going around and everybody's like, oh, this is real stuff.
Mm-mm.
I didn't watch that stuff. Even though it ended up being fake, I was still like, no, I'm not gonna watch it because that it's too real. You know, I
Yeah.
have no desire to see real humans dying. That's just that's
Exactly.
disgusting to me. Now,
Same.
fake people like people
Great.
fake dying, sure, bring it
All
on.
day.
Like,
All day long.
yeah.
Fiction all day.
Yeah, Evil Dead is my favorite franchise. People get tore up in that stuff. So
Yes.
it's really gruesome in those. But you know, it was funny too, because I've seen it pop up and I saw you respond to it today. There was a tweet where somebody made who's like, oh, anybody who likes these movies, it's disgusting, it needs help. And I'm just like, shut up. Like,
Yeah.
stop trying to moralize, you know, what people watch and what people enjoy. Just because people watch this doesn't mean they're sick or disturbed or anything else like that. We watch horror movies and stuff like this to feel better about our lives. It's kind of like what Jigsaw's whole thing is, he puts people in these traps to, you know, appreciate their lives. It's kind of what we watch horror movies for. We watch death and destruction and everything like that to feel like not better about our lives, but to like appreciate our lives in a way, you know. That's a portion of it anyway.
Yeah, I think so. And
So.
I think it's just like it's good to examine why you like what you like and what you're getting out of
Yeah.
it, you know, because I think like if you do want to watch actual, you know, if Faces, I think Traces of Death maybe is the one that's real. I'm not sure, I get
Oh,
them
okay.
mixed up.
Yeah.
But like, if you do want to watch actual real violence and you're like, this is fun, I like watching this, like, you should maybe investigate that and
Yeah.
decide how you feel about it. It's hard to stand outside someone and say, you're sick and you have mental problems and you need help for liking such and such a thing. It's like,
Right.
you know, and it's Twitter rage bait, so I get
Oh,
it.
of
I just
course.
thought it
Oh,
was
yeah,
kind of, I
absolutely.
wanted to screenshot it because I love when people
Yeah.
call me a sick fuck and stuff like that.
I think it's funny. I just every time there's so much like, yeah, the rage bait on Twitter. It's so stupid, and too many people engage with it. Like it's like you'll never see me engage with that stuff.
No.
I've engaged a couple of times with some weird discourse and I try not to. Just because it doesn't get me anywhere and
no, nobody nothing cares. Good comes of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it just so I just when I see that stuff, I just chuckle and scroll on. Because it's just like I know people are doing it's like the nudity and sex debate that gets pulled up every 2 weeks on the on there and yeah. everything. It's like, shut up. Like just if you don't want to watch that stuff, fine. But stop trying to you police everybody else's stuff.
Yes.
So but yeah. And this is the same thing, you know. It's like, I mean, you're writing a book about this. And so I think, you know, obviously, you know, you're coming at it from a love of this subgenre.
Yes.
That you are coming at it from a your own perspective. I'm assuming your book is your perspective on it.
Yeah.
More than, you know, more than necessarily an outside analytical look at it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's cool. I like when people come at it from their own perspectives and can kind of, you know, talk about it in a way that, you know, shows why you enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes. Yeah, that's what I like to read. So that I was like, I'll write what I like to read.
Yeah.
I know, you know.
Yeah, I'm interested in it. I can't wait to see it when it comes out.
Me too.
How's it coming along?
It's coming along good. The draft is written, so it's going through the process of being edited and that kind of stuff. So
awesome. Yep.
It's crazy.
That's cool. Is there anything that you don't like about Saw 2?
It is one of my least favorite of the franchise. Yeah, it's lower for me. And I know like a lot of people, it's one of their favorite. I think for me, the time spent in the house is mostly not interesting to me. Like the needle pit is great,
yeah.
But I find a lot of the characters really grating and I just want to get back like Jigsaw. and then once the Amanda reveal happens, I'm excited about that. But before the Amanda reveal happens, she doesn't do much because she's kind of guiding the action quietly.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not being too out there because she doesn't want to appear like she knows too much. So I think I like a lot of where it ends up, but it's not one I choose to sit down and watch a ton because I'm like, the house. I don't want to suffer through the people in the house.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. The people in the house are kind of like obnoxious, mm-hmm. To say the least.
Yeah.
But it's, I think I give it higher marks overall because of just how much it lays out the mythology. Like we said,
yes.
For number one is kind of the prelude. Number two kind of solidifies and really sets down everything that is to come afterward. And it opens up the world in a way that number one didn't, because number one was so contained that it number two then breaks it out into this bigger world. And especially for the next few installments that follow along with Matthews and the others that come.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that aspect of it, but like, I agree, between the obnoxious people, and I don't really care for Matthews either. I think Matthews is not the greatest character.
No,
he's kind of thin. But I do appreciate all the Jigsaw and Amanda stuff. So all of that aspect of it, makes it worth getting through all the other stuff for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I like, Detective Carrie spending time with her. She's very interesting and nobody's listening to her. So
I wish we had actually gotten more of her in the series. She's comes and goes way too fast in the series. And I would have preferred her to be more in it. That's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. So what was your favorite kill or favorite scene in this one?
Well, my favorite, so it's not a kill, but like my favorite trap is Amanda going into the needle pit. Again,
the needle pit, yeah.
Another basic pick, but I love Amanda. I love her as a character. That scene is brutal to watch. Like, it's a really good trap. And I think it shows the character of Amanda, it shows her commitment to the mission, because as she's, you know, setting everything up with Jigsaw, she doesn't know she's going into the needle pit. That's not like a part of the plan. It's something that goes off plan, and she makes it work. So I think it tells us a lot about Amanda. So I love that part. And then I think my favorite part of the movie is the reveal that Amanda's working with Jigsaw. Like, I wanted to stand up and cheer for her when I saw that. I just thought that was awesome.
Well, I saw the poll that Devon Taylor had put out about which was the best Jigsaw protege, and kind of his reasoning behind them all, and like kind of comparing them to different Batman proteges, which I thought was actually a funny comparison. I take it you're a huge Amanda fan.
Yes, she's obviously the best one. She's the only actual devoted one.
That's funny.
Yeah, Devon and I can go toe-to-toe on that.
I haven't made up my mind on it yet.
That's fair. I mean, I haven't finished watching them.
But I like Amanda, but I also think she has issues. Hoffman, I think Hoffman's good, but also at the same time, he's got issues. He's got his own issues going on. So, there's one I'm kind of edging towards, but like I don't know if it was one of the ones that was mentioned. It was Amanda, Hoffman, Gordon, and who was the fourth one?
Logan, who I think you haven't met yet.
Okay, that must be in Jigsaw.
Yes.
So I don't know any of those, but mine is somebody who isn't any of those four.
Jill.
Jill.
Yeah.
So
Jill is also a good answer. She's the definition of stand by your man.
Yeah, and she's and you don't find out about her until much later. Spoilers for everybody, but you don't find out about her until much later.
Oh, this whole episode has spoiled the whole franchise.
Oh, like, yeah, exactly.
Put a little.
If you have not watched
it,
all of these,
tried not
you
to.
Listen to this. Yeah.
I tried to keep it contained, but here we are. It is hard to talk about
it. Really,
pieces
is.
Of the franchise, you know,
because they all kind of collapse in on each other eventually. With each successive installment, they inform you they make you go back and examine the previous installments and go, you know, this could have existed in that moment. So it's interesting. But yeah, so Jill's probably my pick at this moment. But that's having gotten up to number six so far.
I can't wait to hear what you think of Seven and Jigsaw.
I'll be talking to I've got you on for this episode. The next episode is with Christy Adams from Nightmare Toys.
Nice.
And then episode three is with Kat Velour. That's on Saw 5 and 6. And then Saw 7 and Jigsaw is with Kat Hughes.
Perfect.
And then for Spiral and Saw X, it will be my daughter Katrina.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting to
Katrina's take on the new films. I always like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's really fun with this too, because she wasn't into horror for most of her life. And then in her later high school years, she kind of started watching stuff, and she actually started with watching the Saw franchise. And so I was just like, and I found out later after she'd watched them, I was like, really, that's what you started with? So
excellent.
I was like, that's a bizarre thing to start with. It was like, I could have eased you into some other stuff.
Nope.
She went straight into it, and she enjoyed it.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So it'll be fun to talk to her about. I think it's interesting though too that I have all women guests for this series. Saw seems to be a fairly like woman centric, like a woman that has a large women fan base.
It's for the girlies. You know,
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that that's how it kind of fell into it. Like all the people who volunteered for episodes were all women.
I love that.
That's very cool. Yeah.
When I went to see Spiral in the theater, it was still definitely, you know, COVID times. And in my theater, there were three or four other women. And like, that was it. The theater was otherwise empty. It was me and three or four other women who are all my age or older. And I was like, we all need to just be best friends. Like, we all live in this town and we're all here seeing a matinee of Spiral. Like, it was just, I was like, this is not the crowd I expected. And I love it.
That's funny. Yeah, no, that was Spiral. It was actually, my daughter works at a theater now. And it has been working at a theater since just before Spiral came out. And Spiral is actually the first movie she and I watched together after she started working there.
Nice.
So yeah. So it was pretty funny. But yeah, so it's gonna be good to get her on for the last episode for that. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it'll also be my second anniversary show. So
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So
I'm excited to listen to this whole series and all the guests you just named. Yeah. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. It's all people that I've had on the show multiple times, and everybody's awesome. So it's going to be a fun series for everybody, I think.
Yay, so, Saw season.
Yeah, Saw season. and it's all coming out in October, so it's going to be Sawtober.
It's perfect.
I had originally had it planned so that we would watch the next movie, the Saw X, at the end of October, and then Katrina and I would record, and then it would come out like the literally the Monday after it came out. But they moved it
then
up.
They
a
moved
month,
the date up. So. That messed up everybody's podcasting schedules. Can I tell you, like, all of the podcasts that are doing Saw retrospectives were counting on that late October release date.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still releasing it on the same day that I was originally going to do it. It's just going to be a month later. So
yes.
Instead of the weekend later. So that, which works okay for me. Too. It gives me a little bit of time.
People,
Yeah.
And like, people can actually go see it before they listen to the episode.
Yeah, exactly. And since mine tend to be very spoiler filled, it'll make it a lot easier for that. So
yes.
So, all right. Is there any other things that we want to touch on that we haven't yet with this one, with Saw 2?
I don't think so. Just that Jigsaw is a really intimidating villain, even when he's eating soup.
Yeah, he's, you know, breathing with an oxygen mask and everything. Yes. So yeah,
he still cuts an intimidating figure.
Yeah, no, Tobin Bell definitely makes for a good villain for sure.
Yes, yes,
I agree. All right. Well, why don't you let people know where they can find you online?
Absolutely. You can find me in your closet with a pig mask on, waiting to kidnap you. You can also find me on all the socials at @Ari_Hellraiser, and you can check out my writing at ghoulsmagazine.com.
Awesome. Excellent. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on and kicking off this Sawtober series for me.
Oh, I'm honored. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I knew whenever I was doing it, you were the first person I had to grab. So,
oh, well, I love that. I'm so glad that people think of me when they think of Saw.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again to Ariel for joining me. On Friday, Kevin Yerk joins me to talk about Doctor Strange. And on Monday, Christy Adams joins me for Saw 3 and 4. Thanks for listening. Creepy and Geeky is a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Please check out morbidlybeautiful.com/podcasts for more great shows. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving the show 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, please share the podcast on social media to help spread the word. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. Music for the podcast is Gratitude, composed by Jerry Smith. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm Geek Thulu on Twitter and Blue Sky, and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more on TeePublic or by donating to the coffee page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.